Okay, Josh is doing whispering incantations over the PowerPoint, so we'll start in a moment as soon as he says that. Mayor-elect Wheeler, would you like to come join us? All right. Come, if you change your mind and want to come pound on the table, come on up and pound on it. Okay, are we ready? Welcome everyone to this council budget work session, including our merry band of citizen advisors. Thank you for being here and dedicating an unreasonable amount of time to an unreasonably complex process. But we thank you for that. And we are here to both look ahead into the next fiscal year budget process and to get into our process for the fall budget adjustment effort. We're going to begin, I believe, with both a look back and a forecast preview from our budget director and our economist. So with that, Andrew, I'll let you take it away and have Josh walk us through where we are and where it appears that we're going.
Thank you, Mayor. Andrew Scott, City Budget Director. And we do have a lot of material.
Andrew, it's hard to hear you. Carlos going to
pull that in a little bit.
There we go.
We do have a lot of material to go over today, so we're going to go through a lot of it pretty quickly. As we go through the material, jump in, council, citizen advisors, with any questions you might have or requests for follow-up information, we'll try and answer them now or have follow-up information. But a lot of what we're going to present today provides context for discussion about the 2017-18 budget and beyond. And really a primary goal of this work session today is to get feedback from council on the budget direction that will be issued to bureaus in the next week or so in preparation for next year's budget process. So that's sort of the end game that we're going to lead up to. Great, we've got the agenda up there. We're going to talk a little bit about, do a five-year look back, talk about where we've been in terms of budget reductions for a couple of years, and then add-backs, ongoing and one-time add-backs over the last 3 years. Josh Harwood's going to give a forecast preview in terms of what we know and what we still need to learn between now and when we issue the preliminary forecast in December. Ken Russ, the Chief Financial Officer, is going to talk about some of the long-range trends and long-range risks that he's outlined and things that we need to be aware of as we think about budget decisions and budget guidance. We're going to come back and talk about that budget guidance and process. And then the last section of the work session will be about the fall supplemental budget. And we'll be going through the mayor's proposed supplemental budget and talking through those decisions and any changes or questions that you have before that comes to council next week. Questions on the agenda? All right, let's dive right in. So we have a number of slides that talk about where the city has been fiscally over the last few years. And again, I'll go through these relatively quickly, but we have provided these and we'll email them around as well in case there are follow-up questions later. What this first slide tries to show is when we go back to fiscal year 12-13, and really over the last 5 years, what's happened in that time period? Well, if you remember, back in 12-13, we had about a $14.2 million budget deficit, and we had to take reductions from bureaus in order to plug that hole. In fiscal year 2013-14, we had a $21 million deficit. And what you can see there in terms of the bar charts, we actually ended up cutting about $33.7 million from bureaus in order to have some space and flexibility to add some new programs and important things that were coming up at that period of time as well. Starting in 14, 15, 15, 16, and 16, 17, the fiscal outlook changed pretty dramatically. You can see we had surpluses of $6.1 million, $13.1 million, and $9.2 million in those three-year time period. And again, I think as Josh is going to say, we still are very much in a growth pattern. Revenues still look very positive for the city.
Andrew, it's worth noting for people new to this process that the $21 million deficit that we faced was in part attributed to the library district and the impacts of compression, and also partly attributable to a decision the council had made the prior year to convert some one-time spending that you refer to as the shadow budget into ongoing. And the net effect was the bulk of that deficit was structural rather than economic.
That's exactly right, Commissioner. Yeah, and it was the Housing Bureau, Office of Neighborhood Involvement, and the Portland Development Commission were the one-time funding that was converted in that year. So the next slide dives deeper into what was happening, really, and we divide this between the reductions from 12-13 and 13-14, and then the additions. So what this chart tries to show is looking at those bureau reductions in 12-13 and 13-14, where do they come from? There was about $48.8 million of total reductions, ongoing reductions. So these are really significant in terms of impacts to services and programs in the city. The Police Bureau was the largest single bureau reduction. Fire and Parks and OMF also took significant reductions over those 2 years. And then you can see some of the others around the chart as well. And employee compensation also was reduced by about $4.6 million. That took the form of a delay in the cost of living increase 1 year and then the PERS savings from the PERS reform, which, we've now added back because a fair number of those reforms were thrown out by the courts. The next slide shows a little bit more detail about where those significant ongoing reductions came from. We eliminated four companies in the Fire Bureau. You'll remember we did add a couple of those back through federal grant revenue, and then they were added back again in a recent budget. So these reductions that we're showing here are not necessarily still ongoing today, but they were taken at the time. Parks maintenance reductions, management reductions in parks, within the Police Bureau, reduction in specialty units, patrol officer positions, mounted patrol, economic development cuts in PDC, streetlights and transportation, the Crisis Assessment Center, significant reductions, as I mentioned, in OMF internal services of $9.2 million, those PERS savings of 3.3, and then a span of control study, which did reduce city costs by about $1.1 million by increasing some spans of control. Now we switch to the next 3 years. So again, we had this turnaround, and you know, as Commissioner Fish pointed out, it wasn't all economic, but we dealt with some of the things that we needed to deal with as well to put the budget on a right footing. And what this shows is general fund growth starting in 2013-14 up until 2016-17, and this growth is dramatic, and there's really no there's no other way to put it. But the general fund growth has been extraordinary. I don't ever want to say it's the highest it's ever been because we don't really have the historical figures to say that. But it has been very, very high, and it has grown very, very quickly. Certainly more quickly than the time I've been at the city. And what this chart does is it breaks out that growth into the different components. And so that very bottom part of the chart is the base budget. And so it's just about $420 million general fund discretionary and overhead at that period of time. And if you just continue that over the course of that time period, what we show is the additions to that. There was about $14 million added for inflation and then some other debt and other costs in there. But again, inflation's been relatively low throughout that time period. There was over $25 million added as a result of cost of living increases, PERS increases, and health benefit increases. And you can see that that's outpacing inflation. And this is one of the messages you always hear from us. And I know it begins to sound a little like a broken record, but whenever we hire city employees, their costs usually outpace revenue in the long run. However, you can see in the last 3 years, that's not the case. Revenue has actually exceeded those overall employees' costs. But when we look over the long run, those increase in employee costs generally exceed the pace of our big five general fund revenue sources.
I think if I remember correctly, particularly given the good work that BHR has done on controlling health costs, that most of that increase is PERS and COLA in that order. Right?
Health benefit increases have been very low over the last few years, historically speaking. And then the blue section of that, $36.2 million, that is the ongoing amount added above the base budget. So, again, that's the amount that the city added in addition to programs that we were already doing. And then the green on top, we wanted to layer on the one-time, which, again, as you can see, is very cyclical and goes up and down quite a bit, but has been a very significant amount of one-time over the last few years as well. So the next two charts just go into this in a little bit more detail, shows where those ongoing program enhancements have gone, and this is just that $36 million, that blue section of the chart. You can see Parks is the biggest winner over the last 3 years, and I'm going to show on the next slide why that is. Police and housing really were sort of next in line, and that housing amount, the $6.5 million, does include the $5 million current appropriation level target adjustment that Council gave to the Housing Bureau last year. And then a number of other additions as well to other bureaus, and including the Portland building costs are shown in there as well. Significant ongoing adds on the next slide. This breaks it down in a little bit more detail. When we talk about parks, the biggest components of that, this obviously doesn't include everything, but the biggest components were that conversion of seasonals to permanent, about $4.7 million. Parks O&M, so as we've continued to expand parks into new areas, purchase land and open new parks, the O&M comes along with that, and so that's about $2.5 million. And the youth programming that was added in, another $2 million. In the police bureau, we had additional recruitment efforts, mostly through background investigators. We had ongoing funding for body-worn camera costs, including some of the data storage and other costs involved with that. We converted Hooper Detox and Cheers, which had been on that shadow list Commissioner Fish mentioned for years and years and years. We were able to convert that over into an ongoing program. And then within the Housing Bureau, housing for vulnerable populations at about $2 million. The prevention and diversion program is just under $2 million. And then the Housing Investment Fund, $1.2 million, and some East Portland home repair. And then, as I mentioned, the firefighter companies were restored, $2.7 million to backfill the federal grant that went away, and then some dispatch positions at BOAC. And then the last breakdown is just to talk about some of that one-time funding that came into the city. And as I mentioned, it's a very large amount. Over this three-year period of time, there was $92 million of one-time that came in the forecast that was allocated in the budget. PBOD and housing were the biggest winners in terms of receiving that one-time. Parks, police, and OMF and special appropriations were next. And then moving on to the next slide with a little bit more detail, you can see specifically where some of that money went. Infrastructure improvements in transportation, over $20 million was allocated for that. The youth bus pass has been about $2.3 million, Southwest Corridor about $1.6. Within housing, housing placement, shelter and street engagement, housing investment fund, and home retention and assistance, significant one-time investments in those programs. Infrastructure improvements of over $6 million in the Parks Bureau. The Police Bureau showing the carryover in terms of that. And Jeremy, remind me the carryover on the Police Bureau.
Curious, just programs that were started, mostly one-time programs, that they would just carry over from year to year. So some of those, like with the body cameras, for that's example, right. You would see one time, but that's going to be carried over for a few years. So it kind of duplicates itself year after year.
And this does happen when we have, and it happened in the mid-2000s as well, when we have large amounts of one-time that are allocated out to bureaus, we often do see some of that carryover if they're not able to spend all the funding. We'll talk about that a little bit later when it comes to infrastructure spending. Portland building, $2.5 million, indoor track and field, and the Columbia River levy, sort of rounding out those one-time adds. So I've gone through that pretty quickly. Any questions overall, sort of on the last few years? Then before we get to Josh and the forecast preview, I wanted to touch a little bit on performance in the city. And Shannon Carney's here as well to talk about this. She's the performance management analyst in the city budget office. And what we've delivered to your offices today are the prior year performance reports. And I really encourage you to take a little bit of time with those if you have time over the next few weeks. What we do in those is really highlight we report on the results of city programs and services. We summarize where bureaus ended the year. But we also identify some key citywide themes and recommendations for improvement. And I think as you dive into each one of those for each bureau, there's some really interesting information in there on their performance measures, their key performance measures, and their trends, and where they're headed. Shannon, you want to talk a little bit more about those?
So again, my name is There we go. I'm Shannon Carney, a performance management analyst at the City Budget Office. So, yes, as Andrew mentioned, the FY 2015-16 performance report has been published today, hot off the press. So this is online right now, and it will be delivered to your offices tomorrow. And it really does provide a great summary of, take stock of how Bureau's programs and services ended their programs last year in the context of those year-end financials as well. What we try to do for each bureau is aim to answer the questions, how much did we do? How well did we do it? Is anyone better off? And of course, how do we compare? That is to how we've done in previous years and to other comparable jurisdictions. New features in the performance report this year include an executive summary where we highlight some key citywide themes and identify recommendations for improvement, as well as a couple of changes to the actual performance measure performance charts themselves. So I'll talk a little bit about that. So the prior performance trends. So three big trends really came to mind when we looked through each bureau's performance. They were pretty interesting. The first is the theme of bureau capacity, specifically around hiring. And this was a common thread that we saw around some fairly disparate service areas. So for Bureau of Development Services, Bureau of Emergency Communications, and for the Police Bureau, they seem to be constrained not by a lack of resources, but by an inability to fill their existing authorized positions. The second theme, increased spending on infrastructure is really starting to chip away at our city's asset maintenance backlog. At the same time, this new capital project spending, we're now seeing huge carryover of infrastructure funding from year to year. And that was a surprising finding in the financial analysis. So some of this carryover is appropriate for multi-year financial projects, but the trend also shows really what we found is that the city capacity for delivering on some of these infrastructure projects needs to be enhanced. The third theme reflects the results that we're seeing from the increased investment towards housing and homelessness, which obviously is a key feature of last year's performance. And we did see performance on some measures, relevant measures, improve. At the same time, we're also seeing an adverse effect of course, increasing costs of housing. And we note that, you know, the higher cost of housing will probably make it more difficult in coming years to achieve our goals around housing and homeless services, but also potentially other goals in the city, such as equity and livability. So, as I mentioned, you'll see bureau-by-bureau performance dashboards featured in the report. These link to the online bureau dashboards that you're already probably familiar with. I should note that those online dashboards will be updated early next week. So in terms of changes to the dashboard that you'll see, we added in a historic trend, and that's the line that you see in the middle. And that's really to give a sense of how that measure has trended over the last 5 years, as data is available. And then that supplements what you see at the Bureau performance from this year-end, the FY15-16 performance, as compared to the Bureau's annual target that they've set. So Bureaus have set ambitious but achievable annual targets. They've also set strategic targets that are aimed to communicate the level of service around that measure. So the strategic targets are, you know, more long-term in nature and also include a year by which the Bureau expects to achieve that goal. So as a reminder, the key performance measures, we consider those to be the most useful and selective of performance measures. So that's why we're making those really easily accessible, both in the report and in online dashboards. Thank you.
Shannon.
Okay, we're going to...
All right. We're plowing forward. Okay. I'm Josh Howard, City Economist. We'll start out a little bit with just sort of a general economic discussion. I think a way to frame sort of where we are and sort of in general this region of the country is that when the nation does relatively well, Oregon does a little better than the nation on average, and Portland does a little better than the rest of the state on average, and we're seeing that played out now. In most measures. And so the first table is just a garden variety economic indicators. You guys have seen this before. I'm happy to take any questions on any of them in particular. But otherwise, I think in order to get to everything we need to get to, we'll kind of plow ahead
obviously. If you want to go to the next slide real quick, I think.
Just have a question.
Oh, go ahead, sorry.
On the median home price
for yes.
real estate, when it says it's positive, is that because it's higher or because it's not as as ridiculously expensive?
Well, I think that you bring up a good point. The sentiment around home prices is interesting because the alternative to it being higher is not something you ever want to see in the city. Maybe we're overheated, and I think that there's some of that, and that you don't want to see it jump year over year at this kind of rate. I think we've talked about that before. But you, at the same time, it does speak to some on some level of the city being a good investment for people. And so so I think generally it's positive, but certainly there are parts of the city undoubtedly that cannot sustain the level of growth they've seen. And so if we go to the next slide, this is just a selected indicators that we took and put on the same slide here. I'd like to point out a couple things about this that we've been looking at. The Portland MSA employment, the growth year over year, is starting to slow down. And it's starting to slow down for reasons we believe of essentially a labor shortage. So there are more jobs out there than people that can either fill those jobs because of skills or people available. And you'll see that as you walk around it at what are typically the lower wage jobs and lower skill jobs in retail and in restaurants. There's a lot of, you know, help wanted signs out there. You can see it anecdotally, and I think we're starting to see that sort of in the data, that we just couldn't grow at 3.5% employment growth year over year over year and keep going because we just don't have the labor to do it. And demographically, we don't have labor to do it as our demographics age a little bit, more and more people are leaving the workforce. And so this is not abnormal for this sign. It's not necessarily a downside. The corollary to that is that the unemployment rate is actually ticking up higher. And the unemployment rate is ticking up higher because more people are entering the workforce than were previously. We're almost back to the point of where you would expect demographically our labor force participation to be at least locally. So in neither case is sort of trending in the wrong direction an indication of a weakening economy in this case. It's still very early to make any sort of that correlation. Jeremy goes to the next slide. The other thing that we've been hearing during this expansion, the slow recovery, is that, yeah, great, more people have jobs, but incomes are really stagnating. This next slide shows median family income growth over the last 5 years amongst the 50 biggest cities in America. And you'll notice that Portland grew the fastest on a percentage basis. And so I think what we're starting to see is that next stage of the economic expansion where wages are getting pressured higher. Wages are going up. And it's not just at the wealthy at the high end. You might have noticed last month when the census data came out that at least on a national level, the fastest growth, year-over-year growth, in incomes were at the lowest level of income. And some of that is minimum wage increases, but some of that is wage pressures. To the extent that these typically lower paying service sector jobs can't find people, they have to raise wages to get people to enter the market. And so we're starting to see that level turn. And so go to the next one.
Actually, Josh?
Yeah.
Is there any way to know to what extent the rising incomes are due to people moving here to have high income jobs versus people who are already here seeing their wages go up?
It's a great question. There's definitely two sides of the coin, and it's a little bit of both. And that the next slide tries to get at that a little bit.
Well, is there any way to break out whether communities of color have also seen that, or is it just mainly white folks?
Yeah, we can do that a little bit too. That's actually pretty broad-based as well, especially in terms of a poverty measurement. So again, at the lower end of the wage scales, what we found is that everybody is moving up, actually, and they're moving up the same rates. There's still a disparity between the rates, right? Between whites and communities of color, but they're declining at the same rate. So it's the story is a little bit different than I think it's been in the past, where we had these sort of widening gaps. This next slide I just kind of wanted to highlight because I think sort of the conventional wisdom is we're pushing people mostly to the east. And that is true. I mean, we can see it in the top chart where there's a change in median household income and Gresham actually has seen a little bit of a decline. But what you'll see in the second chart is this is the change in percentage of families under the poverty level. Gresham's also seeing a significant decline in the number of families under the poverty level. So there's a couple things I've worked with my colleagues at the state that we've been bantering about. One explanation is we're actually pushing people out of the metro area, that the cost has actually gotten to the point where people are sort of being displaced out of a broader area. The other thing to note is that Beaverton's poverty rate actually went up. So it's not as clean as sort of we're pushing people out of North Portland and Northeast and incomes are, and we're pushing people east all this, in its entirety. In fact, at this point where we are, Beaverton, Portland, and Vancouver have very similar poverty rates. And that's not something we've seen in the past. And Gresham's still higher, but it's dropped quite a bit.
Josh, I want to go back because I want to make sure we didn't skip over, because I think it's a really, when we talk about gentrification in the city, when we talk about displacement, that top chart really is, I mean, again, it's a hypothesis, but the data seems to be playing it out that the reason why that median income in Gresham is going down is because the low-income people in Portland are moving there. So it's not that Gresham's doing anything wrong in terms of economic development and Portland's doing something right. It's that as our housing prices continue to grow, as our economy grows, and people are can't live here, the low-income people are moving out and then potentially even moving out of the metro area. So this is something that I think is really worth tracking to sort of see through the economic data if we can see some of that population movement and then, you know, start talking about ways to address it.
Yeah, and then coupling that with the second chart, what we're seeing also is that though their lower incomes are moving out, they're above poverty level. So people are moving out of poverty even in that case. So
can I ask a question? When you say out of poverty, poverty is extremely low. And our housing market, and I noticed you had back here that if I read the chart right, there was an increase in vacancies for housing. But that's all of the city. That's not affordable housing. That is strictly all of the city, an increase in vacancies. So in reality, in East Portland, because that's where I come from, it's just the opposite. There's not affordable housing, and the people, even if they're slightly above the poverty level, they can't afford the housing that's there.
No, I think the data plays that out exactly. So even if they're above the poverty level and they move to Gresham, for instance, they lower the poverty levels in Gresham, right, because they're above mm-hmm. poverty, but they still may lower the median incomes because right. they still may be below median. They might be in between that gap. So absolutely, that plays out. And yes, that's citywide, so to the extent we've seen increases in vacancy rates, they've been at the high end. Developers will always build the most profitable product first and an expansion, and that's what's happened. And so we're seeing vacancy rates come up and rents actually come down at the higher end already. How long it takes to filter through the market remains to be seen, but there's lots of development still in the pipeline that I would suspect that's a longer-term trend that we'll see. Finally, this just was an interesting chart, so I threw it in there. You know, we talk a lot about the younger people moving to Portland and driving the housing crunch. And what we're finding is over the last 5 years, what's ended up happening is, sure, we've seen an increase in the population of millennials, per se. I'm using this broad term, but of people older. But they're actually demanding fewer households. So what's actually happening is, I mean, the story would be they're moving here, but they're having to cohabitate in a greater number than they've had before because the housing costs are higher. And that the actual driver of a lot of sort of the housing crunch is actually in that middle band. It's actually in the 35 to 64 band. People moving here maybe a little later in their career with a little more wealth, a little more options, and that's driving a lot of the housing crunch. And so, again, neither here nor there necessarily, but I thought it was sort of an interesting point. Now on to what most people want to hear me talk about here, at least, the general fund and the forecast. We just threw this chart together. The National League of Cities put together a composite of their members' general funds over the course of the last 10 years, essentially. So going into the recession and then coming out. And that's the red line there. And they're both indexed to 100. It doesn't mean anything other than to be able to put them on the same scale. And so what we'll see is the National League of Cities, the red bar, is the sort of typical city in America has not even recovered their general fund back to where it was in 2006. And what you notice is that the city of Portland is about 25% above what we were in 2006. And the last 2 years have provided the bulk of that growth. And so just keep that as a frame of mind for sort of where we are, where we think we're going. As we move to the December forecast, we're sort of, this always comes at a little bit of an awkward time where we kind of know some stuff, but really not enough to make a lot of definitive points. Property tax is the one place where we are definitive. We got property tax data a couple weeks ago. We're going to be about 2 million, maybe a little bit more than that, above forecast. That's about right. It's a little less than 1%. I'm perfectly comfortable with that. Those are ongoing adds. Property taxes are base building. Our property tax system kind of runs on an alternate universe system that allows for that to be base building and just grows. And then the third quarter business license tax payments, we're a little bit leery about right now. They were down actually a little bit from a year ago. Not a lot. And the third quarter can be telling, but it's really the fourth quarter that's going to matter. And so we're going to wait to make any decisions about that in December or January. I'm going to meet with Thomas and Terry over at the revenue division to kind of flush out some of that stuff as we move over the next few months. The really telling point budgetarily, though, is the $11 million at least in likely ongoing costs that we're adding to the budget. That's sort of where the story is at this point, and you know most of these. The PPA contract, the housing IGA, we had some overhead model cost pool updates, which Andrew's happy to go into in detail for you if you want. We still have some outstanding labor issues that we're.
But Andrew, could you remind us again, what's the phase in on the PPA cost?
It phases in over 3 years, but the ongoing cost will need to be dealt with in 17-18. It will free up additional one time. Yeah, in next year's budget, we'll need to deal with the entire $6.6 million ongoing, but about $4 to $4.5 million of that will be freed up in one time for use in 17-18 and 18-19.
So moving on, between now and the forecast release, we will get some revenue information. You can read it there. Lodging taxes will probably be the most meaningful, I suspect, now. We do have a couple of ballot issues that are, well, one really that's not necessarily a local one, and it's a state one, Measure 97, that can have some impacts that we're still trying to flesh out a little bit. Most clearly is on ULF, because a chunk of 97 would assess taxes on utilities, which tend to pass through all those costs to ratepayers, which then they would pay the taxes to us on those additional revenues. So we might see some additional revenues, at least on the ULF side. So we've got a little bit of that going on. We'll do a little more analysis on COLA and health benefit updates, working with HR. Try to figure out that. And then, as you'll see later on today, there's some fall bump adjustments we'll have to incorporate. But as we head to my favorite topic, we're going to forecast the forecast. The revenue should be above what was projected in last April. I mean, I think the economy is still going pretty well, especially as it relates to our revenue streams. We're sort of tied well to those at this point. We're seeing a lot of transactional activity, especially on the real estate side, that's filtering into our business license tax revenues. There's no sign of that letting up immediately, so that should continue a little bit. But we don't expect the surplus to exceed the committed spending we already talked about. So there will likely be a need for some modest cuts. Just sort of thinking broadly, we would need, the last 2 years have been sort of again, you notice that chart with the revenue jumps. We also have many other charts that show these massive revenue jumps. They're unlikely to continue at that level in the same way that we wouldn't suspect the housing market could jump by 15% a year. So we would need another year of sort of record growth to offset those spending commitments at this point. I'm always happy to answer more questions. The question I usually get is, when's the next recession? And my stock answer is, when does the convention center hotel open? But that's not really helpful. So I think it's worth, there was a Bloomberg article, and if you'll indulge me for a second, It said, you have to hand it to economists, they say the darndest things. In a Wall Street Journal survey, a group of economists put the odds of the next downturn happening within the next 4 years at nearly 60%. Saying recession might occur within the next 4 years is a statement that contains almost no information. During the 20th century, there were 20 recessions, or one every 5 years on average. In other words, if you predict a recession within the next 4 years, you will be accurate on average about 80% of the time. It's only slightly more useless than your local weather forecaster predicting the temperatures will fall this winter and rise next summer. The prediction is, of course, absolutely true and of no value whatsoever. Forecasts of recession arriving during the next 4 years are just a waste of print and pixels. The only thing these predictions do accomplish is to remind us that, yes, there is a storm somewhere off in the future, but you can almost never know exactly when it will strike. And I read that not as an indictment of my profession, but rather to recognize its limits. And I think that it's reasonable to assume that in the next 4 to 5 years there'll be a recession, but again, it's only really useful if you know exactly when that's going to occur. So we're really good at telling you why it occurred afterwards. And so I think the important thing is to prepare, right? To be resilient and be thoughtful, both in good times and bad, and follow a recognition of where we are relative to an overall baseline. And we are way above sort of a usual trend line for the city revenue growth and the city budget. Now we're going to talk a little bit about some potential scenarios. Ken, Andrew, and I are going to kind of jump in and talk about some of these things. And Andrew's going to make some suggestions how we might manage through a long-term budget outlook. So if there aren't any questions, I will turn it over to Ken.
I just have one question. It's meant to be a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but to what extent does your forecast anticipate potential political changes? And the reason I say that is that, you know, one candidate for president has said that one of her priorities would be a $250 billion infrastructure program, which could end up being very beneficial to us on basic infrastructure. Another candidate might have said we should abolish, among other agencies, the EPA, which might be the end of our Superfund liability. So, to what extent do you kind of track at all the vagaries of the political process?
No, I appreciate the tongue-in-cheekness of it, but it is something that we pay attention to the extent that it's a downside risk. Usually elections and regime changes are more of a risk to disrupt the current trend in the current system. They're rarely sort of, at least in the near term, sort of a switch that switches on. Sometimes they can be a switch that switches off, but I think, to the extent it changes the long-term trajectory, we'll see that over the long term. There was certainly more risk on one side than the other in this case.
My question is kind of similar. In the event that there is a disaster, could we see a fall of the dollar like we saw the fall of the pound after Brexit?
Disaster politically or disaster? I guess... I think I know what you're saying. There could, except that the institutions outside of the one we're referencing mostly are pretty strong still here, and we're still sort of reserve currency for the world. Interest rates are still really low. It could, but I don't see that as a really big risk today.
Okay, we're going to talk a little bit more about long-range general fund budget scenarios. I'm Ken Russ, the city's chief financial officer, and I've been working with Andrew and Josh this summer. I was trying to put into more numerical form what might happen under different sets of circumstances, some of the long-range financial issues that we're struggling with, some of those which we've shared with the council in the past. So I think last January when we presented the CAFR to council, I had prepared a long-term fiscal health snapshot, basically the stoplight chart that's shown in the handout. And I've broken down some of the longer term, and longer term being issues beyond the five-year forecast, years 6 through 20, the things that that are facing the city. And I broke it down into three categories. Long-term liabilities in the forms of our pension liability with PERS, our FP&R liability, and then our other post-employment benefits that we're obligated to pay. Infrastructure liabilities for our various bureaus, and also some of the legacy liabilities associated with Portland Harbor cleanup and Columbia River levees that we know are going to take additional investments. And then also looking at a third area, just generally employee costs. And the scorecard gave you a view of where things are at today, in my view, and then where we think they might be in the future. And what you'll see is that, generally speaking, things don't look that good and they don't get better. The only item I had in green was really the FPD&R liability, which always surprises people. But that one, we have this odd liability, but we also have an odd way to pay for it, a dedicated tax levy. And generally speaking, under almost any circumstances that we're projecting, that levy will always be adequate. If this is the snapshot back in January, if I was to update this right now, I'm a little more concerned about FPD&R, mostly because of the overturning of the Morrow decision at the PERS level that affects and rolls through FPD&R, some other things associated with FPD&R, the 27-week calculation, and the new labor contract has the tendency to push costs up. And when we run that analysis now about levy adequacy, I think we're going to see that the potential for the levy to actually be insufficient has increased. Still relatively low, but the probability is higher. So just something to be aware of. But those were the kinds of things that we talked with you about long-term that make me a little concerned about how we're going to take down those liabilities. And we talked with you earlier about how we might do that and some of the things that we're facing. We talked about general fund revenue. And as you heard from the discussion with Andrew and Josh, the general fund revenue growth has been spectacular.
Can I ask you just about the a question off the prior slide?
Absolutely.
Every year I push you a little bit, Ken, asking you what it would take for the utilities to go from a yellow to a green. They have stable credit ratings. They have great oversight. Only the members of the pub are here. But just would you remind me what would have to happen for you to shift from stable to improving capacity with our utilities?
Yeah, that's a good question, Commissioner, because I'm not really concerned about their long-term ability to fund their needed capital costs, particularly now with BES through the Big Pipe program and more into taking care of the system. Water is ramping up and taking care of some of its big liabilities at the moment. But they have a funding model. It's rates and charges. There's a financing method that we use. The credits are extremely strong. Water has a AAA credit. Sewers is not very far behind that. And all of the credit review that we get on it is very positive. I think if we saw rate increases tempering and lowering and declining a bit closer to the CPI level, and in fact, with BES, we're getting to a point maybe in the next 10 years where there may not be very much debt financing at all that's required. I think those are the kinds of indicators that would start moving it into the green. I think it's a soft yellow, if you will. I'm not really that worried about it. But I have to put it in a cautionary point because it's really based on affordability. And we know our rates and charges are high, and we know we have a little bit more to take down before we really get into that stability mode.
And I think it's also fair to say that we still have a very uncertain regulatory environment.
Correct.
So I assume you're building in a little bit of caution because we don't know what the next big unfunded mandate might be.
That's correct. So turning to the general fund revenue, we've heard about how great the revenue growth has been, and we can't expect that to continue. I mean, it's unrealistic to see that kind of increases over time. So we know that it's unlikely to have a repeat of that going forward. We also know that some of the things that will produce additional general fund revenue, like expiration of urban renewal districts and the return of tax revenues to the general fund, we really won't see that for probably about 10 years. It's coming, but it's a ways out there. So that's not going to help us in the near term. We know that our outlook for new revenues is positive in that, you know, we've go to the voters periodically for GO bond support, and they've been generous with that. We're asking for that support this fall with the housing program. We have a new gas tax that's taking place. We have a construction excise tax. We have other things that we've done that are going to bring revenues to the table, and that's all positive for us. And we've also talked with you about going after money that's owed to us. We know there's a tax gap. We know that we can put more resources into collecting money that's owed to us, and we're doing some of those things, and that's the kind of thing that we should be investing in and taking advantage of. But ultimately, bottom line for us, it's a math problem. Our revenues are growing slower than our expenses, and our expenses are really being driven primarily by personal services costs, wages, salaries, and benefits. And with that dynamic in place, even with our strong revenue growth, over time, if expenses grow faster than revenues, it's a simple problem for solution. We're going to be cutting expenses, we're going to be cut programs or services, we're going to have some combination of the above to be in balance. And if we don't take action, what we're going to find ourselves in is with chronic shortfalls and reductions in services and the quality of the service that we do provide, And worst case yet, and something that the auditor's office is always concerned about, is are we impairing our long-term fiscal health? So the decisions we make in trying to bring our revenue and expense picture into balance, not just in the short run, but in the longer term, and also being able to have some capacity to deal with the legacy liabilities and other things that we'd like to do as a community, means we have to get our hands around that. Otherwise, we will be at this table cutting budgets every year. And to give a little flavor about what that might look like is where we got into some scenario building, and that's where I'm going to pass it to Josh. Let him talk about some of the different economic scenarios and other assumptions about some of these costs that might be coming to the city over the next few years and what that might look like in terms of an impact on the general fund.
All right, thanks, Ann. So we kind of, we first did this in the beginning of June, I think. So don't get too hung up on the exact numbers because they would change a little bit, but the story is roughly the same. So what we decided to do is build just 10-year scenario models. These are not a forecast. It's simply looking at where are we now, where might we be in 10 years, given different scenarios. And so so we modeled sort of our general fund trend on the tech 9/11 recession, so a milder recession, especially on our revenue streams, the Great Recession, a little bit more dramatic, and then just sort of extended slow growth, sort of a structural deficit problem, and what those would look like. And so we took the baseline expenses, and then at different points in the scenarios, we added on things like the Portland Harbor and Superfund, higher PERS rates, so an assumption of higher PERS rates, and then just potential labor contract costs that might happen in the future. And so this is we can build these scenarios any kind of way, too. So if you're going forward, if you want to look at different things, let us know. But as we move forward, the things to remember, right, expenses are always revenue constrained. So when we give an expense forecast based on revenue scenarios, those are essentially the same thing. And then we've already sort of accounted for baseline future expenses like modest PERS rate increases, COLA, health benefit increases, and sort of debt going away. So I'm going to spend just a second on this sort of initial expense forecast slide, and then I'm not going to spend a ton of time on the individual bar charts going forward because I think we can kind of get a flavor of where we're going this way. And so the orange line is the baseline. So that is if we had no revenue constraints, this is where we would be. And we didn't add any programs other than the ones we're already doing, this is where we'd be. The next green line is sort of the tech 9/11 recession. The Great Recession is the red line. And then the slow growth is sort of, as you can tell, it's sort of a broadening from the baseline as we go further out. And what those means in terms of numbers is on the next bar chart. And the cuts that need to happen.
Before you go forward, because I do just want to point out, it was interesting when we did the modeling. You know, we think of the Great Recession, right, as a huge impact, which it was, and yet you get that huge decline and then a bounce back, and then a lower decline in the tech 9/11 recession. But the slow growth is actually the most terrifying scenario because you see that it just continues to sort of that gap widens as you go out. It ends up being, you know, pretty much by far the worst case scenario if we end up in sort of a structural slow growth economy.
Sure, you can imagine where you're cutting every year some maybe somewhat modest amount, but every year you're doing it, the cumulative effect is much larger. So as we move on, so essentially what we did is we added assumptions as we went. So the next three bar charts, I don't want to spend a ton of time on because the summary table afterwards will sort of get us to where I think we need to go in terms of the thought process. Essentially, we added an assumption of $6 million for harbor restoration. That was sort of a somewhat arbitrary but educated guess as to where we might end up. And if PERS continues, if PERS performance is poor, we're going to have to double our rate impacts every 2 years going out. So that adds about $2.5 million in general fund every 2 years. And then the labor contracts, again, were relatively arbitrary at the time. There was some discussion of PPA, but there are other impacts there. So that number could move around a little bit. And so if we could, I would skip to the summary of scenarios slide.
37.
Slide 37. Thank you. And so here is just sort of a matrix of the scenarios. So the across the top are sort of baseline expense assumptions. And then across the left-hand side are revenue assumptions laid across it. And then the matrix filled in is the amount of ongoing cuts you would need over a 10-year period simply to get out of that 10-year period, given different revenue scenarios. And you can see that you know, what we're talking about are, you know, 7-8% scenarios on the right-hand side of the table, 7-8% scenarios for the entire general fund over a 10-year period. So you're talking about that level of shrinkage. And so this was just sort of a way of kind of looking at where we might end up. Again, not a forecast per se, but just sort of a scenario build and kind of for discussion purposes about seeing the magnitude of potential impacts we could see over the longer term at the city. Without any questions, we can turn over to Andrew to talk a little bit about navigating this.
So, sort of, and I'm going to transition from this into thinking about the budget guidance, because, again, we're trying to sort of set the context in terms of where we've been, looking out into the future at some of those risks. Some of the other financial risks that we are facing, you know, there's additional one-time and ongoing spending pressure around housing and homelessness. And as Josh has mentioned, you know, he's built some labor contract costs in there. You know, there's additional financial pressure around our city plans. As we've mentioned before, we do a really good job of planning. We're very forward-thinking. We push the envelope on a lot of these things with the Portland plan, the comp plan, climate action plan, some of these bureau-specific plans. But a lot of the, in order to meet the aspirational goals that are laid out on these plans, it's going to take a lot of money to do so and require a lot of trade-offs. And I think it's important to keep that in mind as we set these aspirational goals for the city, what those trade-offs may be. You know, in terms of solutions, these won't surprise you. We talk about them, you know, every year, and we've actually made some really good progress in some of these. Investing more in infrastructure repair and replacement, that is the type of investment that will lower that long-term cost curve. Unlike investing in employees, which, again, there may be good reasons to do that, that generally raises your cost curve. Investing in infrastructure lowers your cost curve. Investing more in major maintenance, that is also investing in infrastructure repair and replacement, but doing so increasing Bureau's ability to get ahead of the before the assets get in really bad condition, things that they can fund on an annual basis to prevent things, which is also cheaper to do the earlier we do it. And then I think focusing on performance, you know, and really asking those hard questions about the new programs, are they delivering the results that we want them to deliver? Are the old programs that we're still running still relevant? And doing that look every year. And as I mentioned, this is going to segue straight into budget guidance and priorities. When we think about these challenges and we think about the best way to address them, what a budget process is intended to do is create a mechanism where we can tackle the short-term problems, the immediate things that we're facing in the next 1 to 2 years, make progress on those long-term issues, whether it's incremental progress, whether it's big progress, you know, beginning to think about that, making sure we're making progress, creating budgetary flexibility to invest in priorities. I think that's really key. The priorities of a city change over time. We need to make sure we've got the flexibility. And when I say we, I mean council has the flexibility to move money around, right, to meet some of those new priorities and those new community needs as they come up. But there's always a trade-off there in terms of looking at the things that we have been doing. And the tools you have, you know, that's what a budget process is supposed to do. The tools you have in order to address some of these challenges, it really is the budget guidance. The budget guidance is the direction to bureaus and gets them thinking in the way you want them to be thinking about the future. Using performance metrics, really looking at those key performance measures, really looking at whether the programs are delivering the results you expect them to be delivering. And if they're not, asking the question why. Just because a program isn't delivering doesn't mean it should be cut. It may mean it needs additional investment in order to achieve the results, or it may mean that we need to look at it and decide to redirect those resources elsewhere. And finally, there are other tools such as the Gator sessions, the Government Accountability, Transparency, and Results, which provide a tool that we can really dive deep into some of these problems that we've been seeing that are really intransigent, but do have solutions if we spend the time and analysis and look at the data to get at them. In terms of budget guidance, this chart shows just where we've been. Just sort of wanted to give a little bit of a sense over the last few years of what bureaus have been asked to do. Most recently, in the 2016-17 budget process, bureaus were asked for 5% cuts with the exception of housing. And, you know, the guidance has varied with economic conditions over the last few years. And in terms of budget guidance, on the next slide, As I mentioned, this does set the expectations for bureaus. It gives bureaus and council a chance to look at those new programs and those old programs. I think one of the things there, the third bullet, how do we limit ad packages? I think this is really a key area for council to discuss. Last year's budget, we ended up with $95 million of ad packages. Now, on the one hand, that could be viewed as a positive, right? Because it's bureaus were putting up things that needed to be funded or they felt needed to be funded for us to review and go through. But on the other hand, every time a bureau puts an ad package on the table, it creates an expectation in the community that that package might be funded. And so I think what we saw when we looked at $95 million of ad packages, there were a lot of wish list items on there that bureaus really didn't expect to be funded, but thought, let's just put it out there and see, maybe maybe this is the year we can get it funded. And I think the problem with that is the expectation it creates in the community. And you create a constituency around it that then feels very frustrated when that idea, which really no one internally within the city expected it to move forward, when it doesn't move forward, they don't necessarily understand that. They might have been involved in town halls. They might have been involved in Bureau Budget Advisory Committee meetings, and they feel really let down. So I think there's a balance to hit in terms of bringing forward necessary, high-priority things, but trying to limit sort of the kitchen sink approach in terms of ads. Well, as you know, Commissioner, we recommend against most new ad packages, and I think of the 95. Yeah, well, one of the things that we do try and go to the Budget Advisory Committee meetings, and we try and set the tone, and it's always a very gloomy tone, even in times of good revenue, to try and set those expectations. To be frank, though, I think some of that it needs to come from council. And particularly in our form of government, in terms of those conversations you have with your bureaus and your portfolio, in terms of what those expectations are.
Andrew, what's the cost to your team of having to review all those things and then opine on them? Is there a workload component? And getting to your point about expectations, I think that really has become a problem because you've got all these Christmas tree ornaments on the Christmas tree, and then advocates start saying, "Boy, I hope you fund this and that," and without really understanding that there's not a chance in you know what that we're going to. So what's the burden on you? And to Dan's point, can't the council just say or encourage the mayor as part of the budget guidance just declare that we will not accept ad packages above a certain threshold?
Yeah, I mean, there is, we obviously want to go through every ad package that we get thoroughly. So it is a pretty significant burden, on the analysts. And there's a lot of back and forth with the bureaus as well in terms of asking for data, asking for, performance information, and trying to really understand the request that comes forward. So there's significant burnout, I think, when we're dealing with that number of packages. I don't remember the number of packages last year. I want to say it was 300 ad packages. I know my analysts kept reminding me as we went through the process about how many ad packages they were dealing with. So I think it is something to talk about. And yes, in terms of budget guidance, that is an area where the mayor and council can set limits in terms of what they'd like to see from bureaus.
The challenge, though, with that is it assumes that the bureaus have historically always been funded for doing exactly the right thing, and all you need to do is just increase the CAL from year to year. Whether there's some new programs that the demand has been created for, or you've had to do all these cuts in past years, so you suddenly realize you have no administrative assistance whatsoever, or some of those things. So we need to be more careful about Christmas trees. On the other hand, that there are some functions which may not be particularly shiny, but which need to be added back potentially, and even looking at I'll speak for the Office of Neighborhood Involvement. We put forward a plan last year, knowing we wouldn't get it, but saying this is where we need to get to in order to get equity between the coalitions and amongst communities of color and all the things that we've said as a policy matter we want to do. You can't do that with existing funding.
I think one of the challenges for government in general is that and the political pressure to maintain an existing program is very strong. And so when the new priorities come up, You know, one option is to realign within the base budget. And it's to say, this is a very high priority, and so this is a lower priority, we're going to stop doing that. The problem in any public service is, or in any public program, is that there is always a constituency. I mean, people talk about waste and fraud and abuse, which, you know, you always want to keep an eye out for that. There may be some of it, but it's not pervasive by any means. And when you take away a program, even a low efficiency, low performing program, there are still people being served by it. That will come and testify and be very frustrated. And so that's the challenge, but I think it's something we need to do more of.
Oh, Andrew, the mayor and the guidance developed by the council could say no, or could set a threshold, or could set up a mechanism above a threshold where you would need the mayor's sign off or something to get in the mix, or we could require that you identify an offset for any ad package above a certain amount. So we do have the tools to discipline this. Right now, though, my sense is that we have this conversation every year, but it keeps getting worse. And I think it's time for us as a body, as a group of five, the budget committee, to come